May it please the court, Brent Renison for Carla Freeman. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
Okay.
The government's position is that the second sentence of the immediate relative definition limits the first. In this case, however, we're dealing with a spouse who is a first sentence spouse within that definition, the definition in 8 U.S. Code 1151B. The second sentence of that immediate relative definition sets out a separate and distinct self-petitioning right not seen in the first sentence. It deals with an alien spouse who was married at least 2 years, and we're not dealing with that situation in this case. That is, that section does not modify or limit the first sentence. In this case, there was an adjustment of status application filed along with the petition by the U.S. citizen. And that takes us to 8 U.S. Code 1255, the adjustment of status statute, which is found on page 15 of our opening brief. And Mrs. Freeman qualifies for adjustment of status under that statute. She meets all of the requirements. She filed an application. She's admissible. She's eligible. And a visa number was immediately available when the petition was filed. And that's the wording.
Counsel, how do you get around the waiver?
Your Honor, the visa waiver program?
The one she signed, not the visa waiver program. The language of the visa waiver is that she waives any rights to review or appeal an immigration officer's determination as to my admissibility. She is applying for a status adjustment under Section 245A, which is a change of status for the purpose of changing to, quote, an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence. Has she not waived her claim for review of that status by signing the waiver?
She has waived that and subsequently applied for adjustment of status, which she was allowed to do under the statute.
No. My question to you is that is not the textual breadth of the waiver so broad as to bar her from seeking review here?
No, Your Honor.
Why?
Because she is within a limited group of aliens allowed to apply for adjustment of status. Once she applies, she is taken out of the 217 section.
I'm not talking about whether she fits in one statute or another. I'm talking about the affirmative defense of waiver. Has she not waived her ability to seek review by writing her name under the waiver language which the service, I guess now call something else, put in?
We believe that the waiver was completed. Yes, and that if she were not to have applied for any status, she would be removable under the visa waiver provisions, just as anyone who comes in on that program is subject to its provisions.
Why is she not barred under the language of the waiver?
The waiver exists for the visa waiver entrant. And
only at the port of entry? Is that your argument?
No, in fact, that is one aspect of the waiver.
I mean, is your argument that the words at port of entry in the statute limit the legal ability of the service to require a waiver any broader than the statute?
Your Honor, the waiver... we're not talking about, in this case, the admissibility issue because she was admitted, just the deportability aspect. And we don't believe that she has waived it for that portion particularly because she also applied for adjustment of status. They were placing her in a separate class of aliens.
I know she applied for adjustment of status. I won't take any more of your time. But is your position that the waiver is somehow limited by the statute? The language of the waiver, as to my admissibility, means to the extent that the INS could request a waiver under the statute?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you come back, coming back to your first sentence, second sentence rubric, under the second sentence, it invokes the two-year marital status, which shows up in other parts of the Act and otherwise. Can you address why 2 years isn't some sort of automatic congressional cutoff that we should read the statutes as essentially incorporating?
Yes, Your Honor. The 2 years came into effect in 1986 in the marriage fraud amendments, and it's seen in various places in the Act. The odd thing is that if Mrs. Freeman had been approved for her adjustment of status one day prior to her husband's death, she would be a permanent resident, and she would have been married less than 2 years at the time of his death. The government's position would not be that they could take that status away. Further, spouses who are married for less than 2 years also have a waiver provision. The two-year requirement is just really, in this case, leading us down a path that we don't have to go down, because by the terms of the statute, she does not fall within that coverage.
Okay, well, why don't you say you wanted to save time, or?
Yes.
Could I ask one question before that? When she was allowed to stay in the country, she was given a permit to work here. Was there any term to that permission to stay in the country, or any condition on it? I couldn't find any in the record.
There isn't any condition or term. Pending applicants for adjustment of status are allowed to work, remain here indefinitely until the discretion is exercised. And in this case, we're asking not for the court to ask the government to approve this application, but for the court to ask the government to exercise its discretion. It has not done so in this case. We ask that the court give direction to the government that it can exercise discretion, because it's the government's position that it cannot.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
It is with some trepidation that I launch into this argument, because I spent yesterday reading the Real ID Act. And as the court knows, you have to examine your jurisdiction at every stage of the proceedings. So I cannot go without mentioning the fact that, does the Real ID Act apply to this particular situation? And I'm not sure I can tell you the answer to that. The Real ID Act basically took away jurisdiction from the district courts of all petitions for writs of habeas corpus under 28 United States Code Section 2241, and made the exclusive remedy petitions for review under 8 U.S.C. 1252. This court has recently decided three cases covering the issue that wasn't covered in any of the notes to the legislation with regard to cases that were on appeal. And this court has held that cases that were on appeal from habeas corpus decisions would be treated as petitions for review.
I thought if there was an appeal like this from denial of a writ, that we just view it as if it were a petition for review.
That is what you have decided. But then the next question becomes, that statute says the review is limited to the administrative record. And I think there's enough evidence in this before this court that you can treat it as a petition review, and I think that's what you need to do.
Right, so it seems to me tell me if I'm wrong in this, that if we, and I know you argued the opposite of this, but that if we determine that the court made a mistake, that, in other words, that she was entitled to challenge her removal, then on the second issue of whether the statute, 2-year period bars her, that it might be that under Ventura, we can't even get into that issue and we should just remand.
That's a possibility, Judge. Of course, the question then becomes who you're going to remand it to. The agency.
Not to the district. Well, I don't know. I guess, yeah, I don't think I know the answer to that.
Ventura remand is not for the purposes of remanding to the district court, presumably. At least the rationale of Ventura wasn't.
Right. And see, that's why I said this is a knotty question. I think that a lot of lawyers are out there waiting for the answer, although it's a narrow window. It's only the cases that were on appeal at this particular time. So if I may just finish this one thought.
Is it your suggestion we remand it to the BIA when there's been
no
IJ hearing?
I am not, because this particular case didn't go to the BIA.
I know.
That's why you have to, I think the record you have and the statutes allow, this was the district director's decision. And the question you have to resolve, I think, is under 8 U.S.C. 1187, waiver, does the term in the second paragraph remove mean that the Real ID Act applies? Is it a removal action? And also the regulation, 8 U.S.C. 1217.4b1, where it shall be removed. So the first issue, is this a removal proceeding? Because it's not what Congress envisioned. Congress envisioned the classic immigration court to the BIA, to the Court of Appeals.
Well, okay, it wasn't a classic situation because of the visa waiver program.
Correct.
But if we were to decide that because of the immediate relative petition, she got out of that visa waiver program, restraint, and she should have had an IJ hearing, then what do we do?
Then I think that's what you have to do, remand it back to the agency or dismiss it and let the client file in immigration court, because you know, remand generally would be the district court, and now the district court wouldn't have jurisdiction of a 2241. I believe that's your answer, but as I said, I haven't read any cases on it yet.
What would be the scope of what would be the purpose of the remand at that point then?
Well,
for the IJ, what would the IJ then be determining?
Well,
just to exercise discretion or not?
Yeah, then he'd be back to the, and as the court said earlier, I have gone far afield, and I don't mean to. I want to get back now to
that's
what
okay.
The issues are.
You could finish your thought, because if we have to grapple with this, I'd like to know where we close the loop. Under the Ventura remand type of proceeding, there's some factual or expertise aspect, and you're saying that what it's going back for then under a Ventura type remand would be to the IJ. So
I believe the agency would need to file a notice of action, which would cause it to go to the Immigration Service, and there would be a determination about the waiver and whether or not her applying, or actually her husband applying for an I-130 petition by an alien relative, and whether or not the I-485 should have been granted.
All right.
Can a administrator or executor of the husband's estate substitute in as the petitioner?
I have never read a case to that effect, and I would think not. Because the I-130 is a document that basically is given to what we used to call the immigration INS, and now you call the service, is a document that goes to the government agency that says, I want you to agree with me that this is my wife or this is my child. And it's a certification that that status exists, which allows you then as the alien to apply to adjust your status to that of a lawful permanent resident alien. This particular person was here on a visitor's visa. She was not a lawful permanent resident alien, and she was required to leave the United States after 90 days. I hope I've answered your question. But if I could go back now, hopefully I have addressed, which is going to come up in the next case, this Real ID Act and the potential jurisdictional issues. As this court said, this young lady. I mean, this is an unfortunate circumstance, I agree, and unfortunately the law is the law. It's like...
Well, that's what we're supposed to try to decide here. So the question is, what's your response? At least my question is, with respect to the construction of the relative petition, what's wrong with the petitioner's reading about first sentence, second sentence, that she basically has been under the aegis of her husband's petition, and the fact that he dies should not throw her into the second sentence, which is for those where no petition for a relief had been filed by the husband.
Well, I joined Judge Panner in reading that statute to say that...
Well, Judge Tanner deferred. He didn't enter... he deferred to the agency, so... And there's some question about our Chevron deference. So what's... your analysis?
My reading of that statute is that on its face it says you have to be married 2 years first. And then if you're married 2 years and your husband dies and you haven't applied for adjustment of status, you may do that within 2 years.
That's so where does it say you have to be married 2 years to be a spouse?
Okay. The way I read it, in the case of an alien who has a spouse of a citizen of the United States for at least 2 years at the time of the citizen's death, that at least 2 years, I believe, is a qualifier for the second, that you have to file within 2 years. Reasonable minds can differ on the reading of the statute. That's the way I read it. That's the way the agency read it.
So you'd say it's ambiguous or it's absolutely clear?
To me, it's absolutely clear.
Even though reasonable minds could differ?
Yes. Because my reasonable mind doesn't differ. Others may disagree with me.
All right.
And I'm getting running out of time. As I said, this is an unfortunate circumstance for this woman. It's too bad the law is as it is, but I believe when she entered the United States, entered and signed the waiver, that she overstayed her visa. She wasn't married for 2 years, and it's time for her to go.
Even though that would distinguish them, she signed a waiver, and so therefore you're not saying that the waiver prevents her from getting review of any part of this? Or are you? In other words, you're saying that once the husband applied for adjustment of status, that she's still bound by the waiver, so that because she came under the preferential program, she has lesser rights than somebody who didn't?
Yes.
That's an interesting position for the government to take. Okay.
Thank you.
And
Judge,
may I just conclude? You still have a little bit of time. If the husband's petition was about to be approved, or had been approved. Let's say we'll take the hypothetical that the petitioner argued, that even though they hadn't been married 2 years, it was granted. Therefore, she was now a lawful permanent resident under her husband's auspices, even though they hadn't been married 2 years. That scenario is a legally permissible and practically achievable status. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, although I have not asked the agency whether they wait for 2 years before they grant those or
not. There's no evidence in the record.
No, absolutely not.
So the conundrum is that if he had died the next day after, even though they'd only been married 18 months, let us say, 2 years talismanic aspect wouldn't make any difference.
That's correct. The analysis that the appellant's counsel made would be correct.
Okay. Thank you. You can respond on the Real ID Act if you have a view on it, too, since that's an argument that's just been advanced. You can take a couple minutes on that if you care to.
Yes, Your Honors. My time is very short, and just with respect to Real ID, don't think it makes any material difference here. The current state of this, the immigration court itself will generally not rule on I-130 petitions. They don't have jurisdiction of the regulations. The agency has jurisdiction generally for both petitions and applications for adjustment of status, but the immigration court only has adjustment of status. So some action would need to be taken by the agency itself.
So the remand, if we were to, you said you wanted the agency to exercise discretion. Let's assume we agreed with you and kicked it back down. The remand would be to the BIA, in your view?
again, the BIA also is limited in its regulations.
To whom should we remand then for exercise of discretion?
The district director appears to be the
district director. Okay.
Yes. And then in terms, I think there's a misunderstanding here in the government's reasoning about this. The person doesn't have to be married for 2 years in order for the government to act. A government can act days, weeks, months, however long it wants to take. It can act right away on a marriage that's 1 day old. It can approve somebody for permanent residence, and I think that is an error here. I see it. I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. We thank both counsel for their arguments, and we will submit the case.